This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 341 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by a couple of co-hosts. First, we have our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Great to be here again, 2 weeks in a row. Definitely a trend, but I got to tell you, I'm really, really, really upset.
Well, why is that?
Well, I've been doing all this traveling, and my computer bag has kind of disintegrated, and I need a new one, and I can't find a decent one anywhere, so I'm hoping our community can send me an email or two at brian@airplanegeeks.com with their suggestion over the best bag that they think is appropriate, and I'll take a look at them.
All right, yeah, I'm sure our audience has some great ideas. We're also joined this episode by Bene Wilson, the aviation queen.
All hail the queen. Hello, everyone.
Now, Bene, you've had a little bit of a career change recently, haven't you?
Yes, I am now the founder and sole proprietor of Aviation Queen, LLC.
Wow. And
yay.
And what fantastic services is Aviation Queen, LLC going to provide?
Anything that anybody will write a check for, that's legal, of course. No, freelance writing, social media consulting, that sort of thing, all in the aviation space.
Fantastic. Our guest this episode is Daniel Morley. Now, Daniel's a college student. He's studying human factors in aviation at Nova Southeastern University. He's also training to become a commercial pilot. But Daniel also works at airlinegeeks.com as a social media manager. Now, it's airline geeks, not airplane geeks, just to make sure we get the separation there. And Daniel helps manage the social media. He pushes articles, interacts with readers, and occasionally writes articles himself. So, Daniel, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, we've spoken before with Ryan Ewing, who was the founder of Airline Geeks, and it's kind of grown to include quite a number of participants, contributors, and so forth, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think around this time last year, there's only about five or six people, and right now we have two editors, two social media managers, and probably about six or seven writers.
Fantastic. And are you guys all as young as Ryan?
Most of us are, yeah. I think I'm the second oldest at 19.
Oh, wow.
And Grandpa. I think, yeah. I think the youngest person we currently have writing for us is 14 or 15.
This is fantastic. I love this, Daniel. This is really great. And you guys are doing a fantastic job. We're going to talk about that some more, talk about the Airline Geeks site and also some of the other things that you're doing. But before we do that, we've got some aviation news from the past week. We also have an Australia desk coming up. Also, an interesting listener recording. And we have some listener feedback as well. So why don't we get started right away with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
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 Our first story comes from the Runway Girl Network. This is the Internet of Things, coming soon to an airline near you. Now, the Internet of Things, which you'll see shortened to IoT, it's an idea where the physical things in our lives have sensors. They have computational power, but also they're interconnected and share information. An example of that might be some of the things that are going on in home automation, home heating and air conditioning control, lots of devices in that space that let you control all the aspects of your home. That's kind of an example of that. Well, this article looks at how the Internet of Things might impact the airline industry. And they give some examples concerning, well, jet engines, some of the interesting data that General Electric and Pratt & Whitney are working with. The GEnx engine has, it says in this article, 5,000 individual data points analyzed per second. That's a lot of data. Also, Pratt & Whitney collects about a half a terabyte of data per flight, engine data and related data. And this opens up the opportunity, I think, for some interesting applications, some benefits to the airlines as well as the OEMs. What do you guys think about all this?
Yeah, from a standpoint of predictive analytics, I think it's fantastic. I mean, just imagine if you have something as complex as an engine and you have a whole bunch of sensors on it and they could give you data, you know, when it needs to be overhauled or not, or what specific work needs to be done instead of doing a complete overhaul. So I see that as being tremendously beneficial.
And there's just so much data that can be collected and massaged and, you know, just drawn up. A friend of mine is the founder and owner of MossFlight, which is a data company. They have all their data in the clouds, and they work with airlines and other aviation customers going through all of their data and just coming up with just amazing numbers and metrics. And it's just amazing.
One of the things that the story didn't focus on was really the passenger experience. And I was wondering if that was on purpose or what they were going after. Because I think that it would be really great, since everyone has their smartphone with them, they know where they are. Nothing like being at the boarding gate listening for an announcement, you know, this passenger so-and-so get to gate XYZ so we could depart on time. Well, if they have a sensor in the phone, they know where you are. They know if you're in the airport or close to the gate or sitting at the bar or wherever. I think that would be great. Also other personal data, knowing if you're a vegetarian, knowing what meals to load on board the plane. There's just a whole bunch of stuff I think that you could do with sensors and really improve the passenger experience.
It's interesting because, you know, you're talking about sensors, but if you look at what Miami Airport is doing, they're using beacons, and Amsterdam Schiphol is doing the same thing. They have beacons all over the airport, and Miami is still in the early stages, but the way they've got it set up, they'll be able to do just what you said. You know, they'll be able, if you're walking by a Starbucks and they know that you're a Starbucks user, you know, they'll shoot you a coupon or say Starbucks up ahead, you know, that sort of thing, customized or PaxX type of stuff.
It gets a little creepy though, and there are some privacy issues maybe concerning some of this stuff. I mean, just, you know, how much data do you want out there about you and what you're doing? I don't know, Daniel, you're kind of a different generation maybe than the rest of us. How do you view this kind of a thing? Do you think this is a threat to personal privacy, or what is the buzz concerning the Internet of Things in your world, if any?
Well, for the maintenance part of it, it would definitely, I see it definitely as beneficial. It would help reduce costs, reduce downtime, as mechanics will be able to identify issues quicker and be able to pinpoint what's wrong with an engine rather than having to dig around and seeing what's wrong. Seeing it from the passenger experience side, there is the issue of privacy, but from my generation's point of view, it's sort of like we're already got this information out here, and we'd rather just see where the Starbucks is, using the Starbucks example, and get the deal from the Starbucks and really worry about our privacy. Because we feel like they already know we like Starbucks.
Yep.
So we wanted to just get the deal and see what a Starbucks is and really worry about our privacy.
I guess that's kind of the answer I sort of expected. I think that, yeah, the older you are, maybe the more concerned about privacy you are. And certainly for the younger folks, it's a different thing. It's more about what you can do with that data, how you can get some value from it, than it is worrying about the privacy of the data. But this is definitely, I think, something that's going to grow. I mean, if you haven't heard about the Internet of Things yet, you're listening to this, I guess you can remember you heard it here first. But it really is growing big. I mean, Intel already has an Internet of Things developer kit. I see that Windows 10 is going to have an Internet of Things version, so that if your refrigerator has got some intelligence to it, it could be running Windows 10. I don't know, Binet, maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not.
I guess I'm one of the, just put me under the category of get tools and the technology and stuff, but I am of that age where privacy is still a concern to me, and I just wonder, while some of the stuff is good, I wonder if we're just going too far in the other, if the pendulum is swinging too far in the other direction.
Well, I guess time will tell. Let's move on. We have an item on Spirit Airlines, a couple of articles. One is from the Sun Sentinel, growing Spirit Airlines to hire 1,500 workers in 2015. Now, I think everyone knows Spirit Airlines, they call themselves an ultra-low-cost carrier. This is the airline where the base airfare is about as low as you can go, and everything else is extra, is a fee.
The Ryanair of America?
Yes, maybe even more so, but without the quite the charismatic leadership. But nevertheless, they plan to bring out some new aircraft and flights this year in 2015, and to do that, they need more people. They actually expect to hire 1,500 people this year, a third of those flight attendants. Some of those pilots, although we don't really see how many of those are pilot jobs. But that's a lot of growth, 1,500 folks for an airline the size of Spirit. But I guess they're doing something right because they're remaining so successful.
Successful and profitable. And I will be the first one to say that I was always one that kind of poo-pooed them and turned my nose up. But then a couple of years ago, Mike Boyd had his aviation conference here in Baltimore, and I went. And Ben Baldanza did a presentation about Spirit. And I will not fly them probably. I'm not the customer they want, but they don't want me. But they're getting the customer that they want. And he made a very compelling case. And Max, I'll send you the link to the blog post I did on his presentation. But, everybody talks about how it's horrible and they'll never fly it again, but they're making money.
Yeah.
And, one of my friends, he had to fly from Fort Lauderdale to Chicago. And he's like, well, I'm going on Spirit. And I'm like, really? He's like, yes, I needed to get there quickly and I needed to get there at the lowest price. And they did it. So.
Yeah, I was the same way at the beginning, I think, with my impression or my opinion of Spirit. I guess I was kind of hoping that they would be unsuccessful because I'm just not a big fan of that business model for myself. But, like you say, maybe I'm not the target customer because, so many people are just, tickets are bought based on price and Spirit's the lowest. And if you want some amenities or some other services, then you can pay for them. If you don't, you don't have to, and you're left with that lowest cost. I guess it would be interesting to see maybe some data. And I don't know, maybe it's out there, maybe it's not, as to what do Spirit customers buy? What is because that's probably where the margin is in their business. I would suspect.
Yeah, I think the answer is they have to buy everything.
Right, right.
Their seat, their food, their bag, their... Oh, you want to see how much they're spending in which area and where the profit dollars are?
Yeah, well, I'd just be curious. Yeah, I mean, how many folks are buying the food, for example, versus saying, no, I'm not going to pay for extra for the food. I'm going to bring my own or just go without. Just it'd be interesting to see of all of the extras that are charged by Spirit? You know, where are people spending their dollars? I wonder if that would be kind of instructive. I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you look at the model, I think that most people are spending it on the bags, because you not only have to get charged for your checked bags, but you get charged for your carry-on too.
Right.
And you know, you get charged for how you do your boarding pass. There's no way to avoid paying a fee for the boarding pass. So you're just, you know. But it works. People decide what's worth it to them and what's not worth it to them. And, you know, they're making money. So I can't be mad at them.
No, I wonder if this will spill over and, well, in different ways, either others copying that business model or, as some have kind of asked, is that will we see the sort of the low standards, particularly for pay, that is characteristic of Spirit? Will that influence, will that spill over into other airlines? Will they, you know, bring those levels down as well? And I don't know if that's a valid concern or not.
The race to the bottom. Yeah. I don't know. I think that it has a lot. And many of the legacy airlines are charging for bags. They're charging for their snack boxes. They're,
right.
You know, if you want an aisle seat or a window seat or an exit row seat, you have to pay for that. So I definitely see them having an impact on the legacy carriers.
Hmm. All right. Next item comes from the Miami New Times. This is TSA secretly interrogates international travelers, Miami activist says. This is about Jonathan Corbett. He has a blog that's called TSA Out of Our Pants, and there's a post in there, Corbett sues TSA over international security interview program. And, you know, there really isn't a whole lot about this program out there, which is part of what Corbett is trying to bring out. It turns out that while he was at Heathrow Airport, I guess on his return leg back to the United States, an American Airlines security contractor asked him some questions. Why was he traveling? How long had he been traveling? Things like that. And Corbett was told that if he didn't answer these questions, that he wouldn't be allowed to board his flight home. So subsequently, in some communication with the airline, he finds that this whole thing is directed by the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and the TSA. But if you ask about the details of this program, it's characterized or it's classified as being SSI, sensitive security information, which means you can't find anything about it. This is interesting. There's kind of a constitutional right issue or question that Corbett is raising. You know, here he is trying to return to his country and being asked these questions not directly by a government official, with the penalty of failing to answer that you can't return back. This is, I don't know, maybe there's more to this story, but it sounds kind of disconcerting.
I don't think there's more to this story, but two things that I want to know is, what does he do for a living that he could afford such a lawsuit? Because that's kind of fun. The other is, having just returned from Germany and being asked those same questions, it goes back to my point over if I only felt safer. They ask some of the most ridiculous questions, such as, do you have an electronic device in your bag? And you say, sure. Then they say, well, what is it? You go, okay, it's an electric shaver. How does that, knowing the fact that there's an electric shaver in my bag, how does that make the flight any safer?
It might not, but if those questions generated some stress on your part that was visible, then it might cause the security guys to probe deeper or look at you more carefully. That whole behavioral thing is something. And actually, Corbett says is that has shown not to be an effective approach. I don't know if it is or not. I think it is in some places in the world. But, you know, those questions that you got, Brian, those were coming from the security guy at the gate?
At the gate. Yeah, the contract security guy. It's the same one that Mr. Corbett's talking about. Yeah, and it drives me crazy because Being the type of person that I am, I like living on the edge a little bit. So I'm traveling with a coworker of mine, and she goes first, so she gets asked the questions. And for the ones that I know won't land me in jail, I answer differently from her. And yet, there's no additional screening whatsoever. There's no difference between how they treated either one of us, regardless of how I answered the questions. And again, it just, I don't feel safer. I find the whole thing a waste of 3-4 minutes out of my life that adds no value whatsoever.
Well, it just reminds me of that phrase that we heard batted about, security theater.
Security theater, yes. Yeah, and it's hard to tell, you know, because we don't know in most cases, I think, when it worked, right? When something was prevented from happening. You don't see the TSA issuing, you know, big press releases saying we thwarted this, you know, this big threat 2 days ago, and yesterday there were these other three threats that we, you know, that we thwarted. You don't see that stuff. It's all behind the scenes.
No, Max, you're absolutely right. And that's where I have, or I'll take exception with my own position over this, because if it truly is making me safer, then it's okay. Then I'll put up with.
Yeah. And it's tough to put up with all this, you know, inconvenience
stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When you don't really know if it's worthwhile. We have to kind of take it on faith. Or in the case of Corbett here, you know, he can take it to the courts.
I just love the fact, though, that part of his argument is being an American citizen, you can't be denied entry back into the country. And here, an airline would say, because you're not answering my questions, I'm going to prevent you from going back home. I just see that as being so completely wrong, and I'm really happy that he is taking this through the court system.
Yeah, in his blog post, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, I think it's worth taking a look at. He says, U.S. citizens have the right to re-enter their home country. We also have the right to remain silent when interacting with government officials. The TSA has secretly tried to trick us into picking only one of those two rights. I instead pick both, as well as my right to petition my government for redress, and have filed suit today against the TSA. I've asked 4 federal judges to rule that the program is an unconstitutional violation of our Fifth Amendment rights, and to enjoin the TSA from enforcing airlines to hire interrogators to sit outside international gates. And if you look at it a little bit more, the reason for the 4 federal judges is because there's actually several different paths that you can, you know, bring this kind of legal action. And if you pick one and it's later deemed to be not the correct path, you should have gone to this other, you know, this other path, then you're out of luck. So he kind of took, a shotgun approach and covered his bases across them all. That's why the 4 different federal judges. But, you know, again, it's hard to tell, you know, just what is going on here. Like he says, Corbett says, if you try to find out more about this program, there's no information anywhere other than the airlines, in this case, American Airlines, saying that this is coming to them through the DHS and the TSA. And if you have any further questions, talk to them. Corbett talked to them, and that's where he runs into the SSI, sensitive security information, and that's a dead end. So, again, we'll put the links in the show notes if you're interested in following this along. Corbett, I guess, has some other suits that he's filed, so definitely, I guess, characterize him as an activist in this area. If you're sympathetic to this kind of thing, you definitely want to check it out. But if you're otherwise interested in just learning about this position, you might want to take a look. All right, some kind of more exciting, at least good sort of news. We have an item from Kansas.com, solar power plane airborne on historic round-the-world trip. So this is the Solar Impulse 2. You may remember the original Solar Impulse, the solar-powered aircraft. Binet, you know, it was scheduled to arrive at the Udvar-Hazy Center last year for the Become a Pilot Day, but it arrived a day late. after most everyone had left. But we stuck around. We hung around and actually got to see it. And it was kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah, I got to see it later that week, you know, because I was waiting to see it too.
Oh,
but
did you?
They had a big, they had a big press event, and I covered it for AOPA, and it was pretty cool, I have to say.
It was, yes, very cool. So now they have the second version, the Solar Impulse 2. On March 9th of this year, it launched from Abu Dhabi, and it's going to take this around-the-world flight. This is not a continuous flight. It's segments, about 25 flights to get around the globe. They figure it will take about 5 months to complete this. But it's quite an aircraft. The thing's got a wingspan that's larger than a 747.
Yeah, I just wonder what's going to happen with that when it hits some turbulence. And they talk about it being made out of carbon fiber and new manufacturing techniques and just something that seems that fragile. Boy, if they hit weather, makes me wonder.
Well, yeah, maybe the lightweight means that it moves with the weather more than, a conventional, aluminum aircraft that's significantly heavier, which is going to try to fight the weather a little bit. But this thing is light. I think, what's the weight of this thing? It's around a ton or something like that.
2,300 kilos.
So roughly 5,000 pounds. Yeah, that's pretty lightweight for sure. It has a little over 17,000 solar cells across the wings, 236-foot wingspan. And this thing can fly day or night because the battery, or the solar cells, rather, can power the four electric motors, but they also recharge some lithium batteries that can run the electric motors for the propellers at night. So this thing can fly at night as well. There's a website that they have for this, which is, as you might guess, solarimpulse.com. You can follow along the journey. Now, if you're going to be in a location where they'll make a stop, you might want to take a look at that. They started in Abu Dhabi. They go to Muscat, then to Ahmedabad, from there to Varanasi, Mandalay, Chongqing, Nanjing. And then from Nanjing in China, they go to Hawaii. After that, on to Phoenix. Then some point in the mid-USA, I guess the not precise location identified, landing in New York. And then from New York to, well, either Europe or Northern Africa, I guess that there's your weather. It may depend on the conditions in the atmosphere, and then finally back to Abu Dhabi. So it's exciting. Follow along at the website. Again, we're speaking with Daniel Morley from AirlineGeeks.com. Daniel, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, we want to talk about Airline Geeks, but before that, maybe a little bit more about what you have going on. You're studying human factors in aviation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means, what that involves?
Yeah. So normally a college degree in aviation would look at the mechanical side of it, like how a plane works, why it flies, and basically it's all mechanical. This degree focuses on the human side of it. So what affects the pilots? Why do pilots do things? We study air crashes. We've studied American 965, which crashed in Cali a couple, like in the 90s, and see why it happened and what could have been done to prevent it.
So you must use as the basis for those kinds of studies the investigation reports?
Yeah, the NTSB reports. We've been watching episodes of Air Crash Investigation, or Mayday, depending where you are, the Nat Geo documentary series.
Hmm.
And we just try to look at how pilots are affected by stuff like fatigue, stress, outside factors, and be able to prevent that in our own future careers.
Sure, yeah. You know, a lot of the results of accident investigations end up being, well, pilot error or something that gets called pilot error. From a process standpoint, though, is it really fair to say that it's not because of some, I'll put it in a kind of a strange way, some defect of the human being, but because of other factors that influences how the human being acts? Is that fair?
Yeah, like the Colgan Air commuter or commuter plane that crashed up in Buffalo a while back, the pilots were fatigued, but their fatigue was caused by the schedule that the airline made them fly and the fact that they had to commute. One of the pilots had to commute from Seattle to Newark to fly and was sleeping on the couch of an airport lounge, I think, or the crew lounge at Newark. So it's not necessarily defects with the humans, but what policies that the airlines and the FAA put in place that can either prevent stuff like that from happening or don't prevent stuff like that from happening.
When you look across some of these accidents, Daniel, and human factors have played a role, let's say, in the outcome, in the accident, what is your sense for how well things are changed going forward to kind of account for those kinds of human factors issues? Do people pay attention to that?
It's definitely become better. One of the things that was a problem early on was CRM, crew resource management, where some early crashes were noticed by the problem was noticed by the co-pilot, but they were afraid to overrule the captain because they believed the captain was right no matter what. And we've seen airlines introduce programs that eliminate that, and because of that there's almost no crashes now because of CRM issues. In fact, CRM has proved to save a few flights. Just off the top of my head, there was Northwest 85 over Alaska was saved. They had a rudder failure, and because the crew was able to act as one unit rather as a captain and his followers, they were able to return the jet back to Alaska.
Hmm. Daniel, how large is the aviation program at your school? How many students?
It's mostly an online program. So at my campus in Davie, Florida, we have about 5 students, but online across the country, I think there's around probably between 25 and 50 students. I'm not sure on the exact numbers.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. Yeah, roughly the size. Do you have any sense for what their aspirations are? I mean, you yourself, you want to become a pilot, right?
Yeah, most of them are trying to become pilots. Some of them also, some people want to use it to be like NTSB investigators or even just to get into the aviation industry in general and are just using this as a catalyst to maybe go on the mechanical side of it later on.
Uh-huh.
Daniel, have you noticed a difference between the online part versus an on-campus part?
It's definitely, you have to have a lot of self-discipline for online because it's not like you have to see your teacher every day or every week. You have to actually make yourself do the reading. And if you don't know it, then your grade's going to reflect that. And there's no real way for the teacher to help you face-to-face. If you're a face-to-face person, you're not going to get that support with online classes. And that's something I've struggled with, is sort of just communicating just by email with a teacher. It's sort of a bit impersonal for me, but I've still found a bit of success in the classes. I'm still passing, so that's good.
Daniel, let me ask, you're working on your pilot's license, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm currently working on my private pilot's license.
And so who are you, where are you taking your classes and doing your flying?
With that, I'm doing it at American Flyers. I'm doing it at their Pompano location or Pompano Beach location, but they have locations across the country. They're sort of like partnered with Nova Southeastern.
Okay.
And it's all done through flyers. Like, I pay the fees through Nova Southeastern, and then I just show up at flyers, and we do our flying work there.
Got it. I was just curious.
Daniel, something that we've talked about, it seems like with increasing frequency, is about the career path for aspiring pilots, and how the wages can be so terribly low at the regionals. We have arguments. Some people say that, you know, that's just keeping people away from the profession. We have people that say that, well, you have to think of it in terms of the long-term plan. And yeah, maybe at first you're not going to really, have a significant income, but that you have to view that as sort of a starting point, and that eventually you can, aspire to be, to fly with the majors and enjoy a much higher salary. How does all this sort of, dial in to your perception of a career as a commercial pilot?
The way I see it is, I love flying, and I'm probably going to have to worry about the money at some point, but I'm not worried about getting paid money as long as I'm flying. It's something I want to do and something I love to do. So it's like that old saying, find something you love and you never work a day in your life.
Right. Yes.
That's sort of how I see it. I know the money's not that great right now, especially with regionals and lower end with the legacies, but I plan to do this for basically till I'm 65 and the FAA kicked me out of the cockpit. So with that, the money will come, and I believe I can succeed doing this.
Yeah.
And another thing that I sort of have in my head is that the airlines are going to, they are right now facing a pilot shortage. So even though wages may be pretty low, many of these regionals are offering bonuses for signing. I think Silver is offering $5,000 to sign. Envy, I think, is offering $6,000 or $7,000 just to sign with them. And once that doesn't draw up the demand they need, I feel like they're going to increase the wages, I guess you can say, simply because they need pilots and they need the money, they need the pilots to fly.
Well, I like that. And the reason I like that is because when I think of the kind of person I want at the pointy end of the tube, I really would like to have someone up there that's doing it for the love of flying rather than someone who's, just doing it for the money, just a job. Now, I mean, I know that's kind of harsh, but and many people don't have the luxury or the option of making a career out of something that they truly, truly love to do. But when it comes to flying the plane, I think that's what I'd look for.
Hey, Daniel, one of the things to keep in mind, on episode 328, we had Brad from ExpressJets on, and he was talking about pilot salaries at ExpressJet after 7-8 years being in the six-figure range. So although the regionals might start out not paying all so great, it seems like, at least at ExpressJets, that you can end up getting a fairly decent salary by sticking with them for a few years.
Yeah, that's what I've seen just doing some research in my spare time, is that with pilots, it's longer that you stay with the airline, the more you get paid. So someone who's a first-year pilot for ExpressJet may only get $36,000, but if they stay with the airline, you could get six figures. It's just whether or not you get tempted away to come back to a legacy carrier like Delta, where you have to weigh the benefits and the drawbacks of, A, you get to fly for Delta, which is the benefit, or the drawback is you go back to being paid $36,000 a year.
Well, I think also with the rules changes that came about after the Colgan Air Buffalo crash, it's kind of put a damper on people having to spend all this money on and get extra training. And I think that the regionals are going to be forced to pay more because they're going to be recruiting from a smaller pool.
Yeah, that's it's really expensive now to get up to, I think, my commercial flight instructor. It's going to cost me $73,000 in total over 4 years. So that's a lot of money. I mean, I earn maybe $10,000 a year with my job, and it's going to be a struggle to get that money, but I'm going to find a way to do it, whether that be student loans or some finding scholarships, some obscure scholarship somewhere, because this is what I want to do. This is what I love. And you have to make sacrifices for what you love. And I plan to make those sacrifices.
Fantastic. I like that. I like that a lot. Daniel, how did you come to be associated with the Airline Geeks crew?
I started following them on Twitter mid-July. And then end of September, I saw they posted a tweet, "Hey, would you like to write for us?" So I went out on a limb and did an application. I didn't really know what they were about back then, how they were all really young. And even that surprised me when I first joined. But I sort of just filled an application and went from there. And right now it's really, I've seen this website grown a lot since October.
Yeah, tell us something about Throwback Thursday.
Throwback Thursday is something me and two other writers started about beginning of January. I got the idea after writing an article about the crash of Air Florida Flight 90. It was the, I want to say like 29th anniversary. I'm not like sure on the exact date. But I thought, would people be interested in a series where we look back at old airlines? And from that, I wrote the first airline, which was Northwest. And we've sort of just rotated on what we want to do. We have done one where the viewers have requested, which was an article I did on Continental. But basically, we've done Northwest, America West, Song, Champion Air, USA 3000, Western Pacific, TWA. And it seems to be really popular. Some people really like to look back at these old airlines and sort of reminisce, I guess. It's that nostalgia effect.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you do the research for these articles?
Basically just trying to find like old, let me see, what's like...
Just don't say Wikipedia, please. Don't
yeah. Wikipedia. like some of these airlines have retired pilots organizations that give history. We try to find news articles. Generally, we just start with a Google search and find some interesting articles on the past, find something that was interesting that happened to the airline, and sort of build off that. We may use Wikipedia just to create a timeline to where to look, but we don't get most of our information from there.
And Wikipedia tells me that the Air Florida flight crashed January 13th, 1982.
82, so that would be... I can't do math.
Yeah, yeah. Don't do math when you're recording.
Yeah.
It was 1982 in that parallel universe. You know that.
Oh, sure.
33 years ago.
33 years ago. I was off by four.
Daniel, didn't I see something about, or didn't I see that you made a comment somewhere about this issue of sort of the accuracy of what you write? And that was a very important thing to you.
Yeah. Because we're all so young, accuracy is something we take very seriously. And because of that, in my mind, there's always a self-doubt that, is this correct, what I'm putting out? And especially with my position on social media, I'm one of the first people to see readers' responses. And 95% of the time, someone's responses is, hey, this is wrong. This is the correct information. Seeing that we put out something wrong kind of demoralizes me a little bit, because people look up to us. I mean, I don't want to say that we're on the same level as someone like Airways News, but we have 10,000 followers. People look up to us, and we want to put out the best information we can and not be put into this category that we're young, so we don't know what we're talking about.
How many times have people said or pointed out what they think is an error, and they end up being wrong, and you got it right.
Not as often as I'd like it to happen.
Ah, oh, darn it. That's what I was hoping for.
But we still, even if something like that would happen, we take it all in stride and be very friendly about it. Because it's all about image. We want to make sure our brand's being spread positively and friendly. We want to be, we interact with most people. If you send us a picture, we'll say, hey, very good, nice picture. Maybe even if we get permission to use it on our website. Because that's how we want to spread our brand, through being the friendly guys who know about airplanes.
Yeah, Daniel, I think that, yeah, as a young staff, having such a young staff, that, yeah, you do have to make sure that the reputation comes through really solidly, because, yeah, people have really short attention spans these days. If there's any reason to move on, people will move on. But other than that, what do you think about any sort of advantages that you have at Airline Geeks because of the relatively young age of the folks there?
I think it gives us a different perspective, because a lot of people who are writing, not to say that's a bad thing to be older, but we have a younger view of it. So someone, like the article about that we were discussing earlier of the Internet of Everything, I believe that's what it's called. I have a different perspective on that than you guys do, because I'm from a different generation. I grew up with technology. So we provide sort of a younger spin on things and stories in aviation. But we still, what's the word I'm looking for? We still strive to give the best content, no matter what our spin on it is.
Well, and I could certainly see things with other bits of technology, like, for example, the use of Twitter. It's taken many of the legacy carriers and many of the legacy people a long time to catch on to Twitter. And for example, I refuse to use it. So shame on me, but still. And this is something that I think you've grown up with and are so incredibly verse in using it. It's just an extension of who you are.
Yeah, it's something I've grown up with, and it seems unusual for me to send a letter or call up an airline when I can send them a tweet or DM them on Twitter. So it's providing a new way of communication and ways for the airlines to interact with their customers and do the same thing basically we're doing at Airline Geeks, is spread our brand.
And what's the engagement of your community like through social media? It's is this something that just kind of happens naturally and frequently, or do you have to sort of pull it out of your audience?
If we post something rare or pretty nice, we definitely will get a couple comments on it. Sometimes we like to do polls to just gauge where people, of what people's opinions are. And then sometimes we try to do like a history and a fact tweet every day. And sometimes it's with the history, it's people saying, oh, I remember them. They were great. Like, recently we tweeted, about the end of Fokker Aviation, their anniversary for their bankruptcy came, and we had people saying it's the end of an era and they'll be missed. Or they are missed.
You know, I know that we have to let you go soon because you've got some homework due for tomorrow. But I did want to touch on this Eastern Airlines launch, and because you attended that event, I think, and we mentioned renewal, the rising of Eastern Airlines, whatever you want to call it, is some episodes ago. But the launch event you attended, have you got any observations from that you could share with our audience?
From what I saw, they had a good plan in place. I mean, I haven't heard anything from them in a while, since the launch, basically. But there was a lot of optimism surrounding it, and there were unveiling plans to rebuild or build a headquarters where the old Eastern headquarters was at MIA.
Right.
And the airport officials were excited about them. The county officials were excited, and it was a very positive event. They seem to have a very positive outlook on their future. I haven't heard much, so I don't know how the plans are. Their plans, when the launch was announced, was to be flying charters, I believe, in April, but I haven't heard anything since, and I can't find anything online. But it's something I really want to see succeed, because it was a really special event for me. It was the first time I've been to a launch of an airline.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, it doesn't, especially in this day and age. I think we've had, like 3 or 4 new airlines in the past 10 years? I'm not sure. You can't quote me on that. But it's exciting, and that's sort of why I joined Airline Geeks, was to be able to do those type of things, stuff that regular people who are just fans of aviation wouldn't be able to do. I mean, I had to get an invite from Eastern Airlines to go down there. So, and stuff like what I'm doing now is why I joined Airline Geeks, to talk about planes.
You know, it's interesting with the Eastern Airlines. I'm sitting here looking at my swag bag. I wasn't there, but my former boss was there. But I did an interview with Ed Wegel, the CEO, before, you know, right before they did the formal launch. And one of the questions I asked him was, I said, you know, the airline industry has not been kind to startups. So, you know, what are you doing that's going to be different than some of the other ones that have come and gone? And I think one of the interesting things that he said was that this version of Eastern was going to be part of the industry. They were going to join Airlines for America. They were going to code share and partner with airlines and, you know, be more a part of the industry. And Mr. Wegel, I think, felt like that would give them a better chance to succeed. And he's somebody that's been in the industry for quite a while. I mean, I knew him from back when I covered the regionals, and he was the president of Chautauqua, and he was also at Mesa. We overlapped there a little bit. So,
Interesting.
Well, looking at their website, their last press release was November 18th, 2014, but yet they have a job posting dated March 12th, 2015. So, looks like they're hiring people, but not making much news.
Maybe that's good for them. Maybe not being in the news is good for them. I just guess I haven't heard from them. But the event was really nice, and it's just something that I'll always remember. They did a flyby of the jet, and just to see that, something that, I mean, when was the last time an Eastern Airlines jet flew?
Yeah.
Probably before I was born. I don't remember when they dissolved, but it was just such a special moment. They invited retirees of Eastern, and just to see the look on their face, to see this beautiful 737 all painted up in the same Eastern colors that they worked on, it was really special.
Ah, I can see that completely. I mean, it must have been a really emotional kind of a moment for an awful lot of the people attending.
It was for a lot of them, and even for someone who, I was born in 96, so I never flew Eastern, and I certainly don't remember much about Eastern, but it just to be part of that history of bringing back such a famous name in airline history is special to me. Sure. And it's something I'll appreciate for a long time.
You were born in 1996?
Oh, God.
Yes. March 8th, 1996.
Please allow me to, I'm going to step away and get my orthopedic shoes and cane. I'll be right back.
Okay, Vinay.
Well, just in regards to Eastern was actually the very first commercial airline that I ever flew on, and it was a 727. I remember the flight very, very clearly, and it was my first time also getting airsick, and the flight attendant was so incredibly kind to me.
Yeah. I used to fly the Eastern.
And I got the wings, and they were made out of metal, which was really cool as well.
Oh, yeah. You don't still have them, do you?
No.
Too bad,
My mother might somewhere in a box of Brian memorabilia.
Yeah,
but just like it was yesterday.
Cool.
I remember that, yeah.
Okay, Daniel, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a great conversation. We'll give you an opportunity to tell our listeners where they can find Airline Geeks Online, and you as well.
Yeah. Our website is simply airlinegeeks.com. That's where you'll find all our articles. On Twitter, it's at Airline Geeks. My personal Twitter is at Morley the Pilot. And you can find that both of those from our websites. And if you'd like to contact me via email, it's daniel@airlinegeeks.com. And if you just want have any suggestions for articles, anything you'd like to see us do, anything that you want to see from us at Airline Geeks, maybe more pictures of airplanes, more news stories about planes. We want to be what our readers want.
Throwback Thursday for PSA?
That is actually coming out. Figuring that you said that, I'm writing that right now.
Yes.
And that's coming out on Thursday.
Oh, I ask, can I receive? Yay.
Yeah.
Very good.
I cannot wait. I'm originally from California, big fan. So
great.
I can't wait to read that.
Okay, Daniel, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
He was born in freaking 1996.
Does that make you feel old, Benet? Does that make you feel old?
Yes, it does. I feel like I should just go get my Social Security check now. Okay, I'm going to let it go now.
Yeah, this is your future.
But it's really great to see some young folks doing this kind of work, with this kind of passion and this kind of quality. I just find it really encouraging, don't you?
I do.
Well, I was joking around with him saying that, what, you have mandatory retirement at age 21?
Yeah. But this is great. I think, young folks are oftentimes looking for ways to get involved in aviation, and maybe they have long-term goals, as Daniel does. But there are lots of things you can do, along the way that get you involved in aviation, but also do things like, build your network, make a lot of contacts, and learn a lot of things that, you don't really have an opportunity to learn unless you're somehow immersed in it. So I think this is fantastic.
Absolutely.
I agree.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 16th of March, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 341. Welcome back, Grant. Tell us about ballooning, mate. As I was travelling into Melbourne this morning, it was a beautiful day here in Melbourne, in fact, and I saw a couple of balloons launching out of the suburb of Richmond, which for listeners who are not local, which would be most of you, is basically inner Melbourne, pretty much. Spectacular, mate. Looked like a really good day for ballooning.
It certainly was, mate. The guys had a lot of fun, but I was back here at home working on all the paperwork and compliance stuff. But yeah, no, we had a pretty good time last week up in Canberra. I actually had to bail out early. I couldn't stick around for the whole week, but because Kit's birthday was on Wednesday and we were going to Cirque du Soleil that night. But I had 4 days of the Canberra Fiesta in Canberra. That was really, really good. The Canberra Balloon Spectacular, as it's now known. Spent the first 2 days on the ground observing as part of the Australian Ballooning Federation. Then went for a flight with one of the balloon pilots I know who also works with CASA. I had a great flight with him and another guy from CASA. That was a beautiful flight. I even wound up doing a live hookup with one of the local radio stations to describe what we were in the middle of flying and how balloons operate and the women fly it forward thing, because we had a few lady pilots flying ladies for their first flights. It was great.
Excellent.
And then on Tuesday morning, I finally got a chance to ride in a chariot. Now, a chariot is a 2-seat side-by-side chairlift kind of thing that you buckle yourself into just with a normal, lift the flap airline seatbelt and go flying in under a hot air balloon. So there's no basket to stand in. You're just sitting there. Your feet are dangling into clear space and you're a couple of thousand feet above the ground. It's awesome.
Oh, God, how to make hot air balloon even more terrifying.
Yeah, I thought you'd probably run screaming from that one.
Oh, that's fantastic, mate. Well, it's all right. I soldiered on last week without you. But in the meantime, we've had the Australian Formula One Grand Prix run here in Melbourne just this past weekend. And I only mention that because we know that Max Flight is such a fan of Formula One. And interestingly, Grant, although this has nothing to do with aviation, we're going to spin it that way. It says here that Red Bull hints that they're going to pull out of Formula One. And I think that's probably a great thing, Grant, because it means they could put more money into, you know, Red Bull flying events like the Red Bull Air Race. See, I'm always thinking.
Yeah, total agreement, mate. No argument. But yes, it does look like Red Bull are having a little bit of a hissy fit about being trounced by Mercedes, as they were last year and are again this year after that first race. But look, I haven't been following it very closely, so I can't really get into the nitty-gritty. All I hope is that you know, the money from Red Bull goes into something really worthwhile, like flying stuff. But, you know, I've got to say, every time I've been to the Formula One, and here in Melbourne I've been many times, both in VIP boxes and just in the paddock, I've been more interested in the aircraft, the F-18 handling display, the roulettes, anything else that's flying over, and, of course, all the helicopters.
Yeah, and there was plenty of those. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story, folks. I was sitting in a meeting at my place of employment the other day when this must have been on a couple of days before the Grand Prix started, and the Air Force was good enough to do a few practice runs over Melbourne, and as this Hornet flew over Melbourne and shook our boardroom from one side to the other, the whole meeting stopped, Grant, and everybody in there was looking at me.
Well, they may have been looking at you during that one because they know you're an airplane geek, but I tell you what, everyone was looking up during the Sunday just before the race when Qantas overflew the race area with a 744 extended range, one of the last few 747-400ERs that they're running. I believe it was Oscar Echo Hotel that did quite a spirited handling display of its own over the top of the crowd.
Yeah, fantastic. In fact, in previous years, they've gone back to flying 737s, which still, you know, let's face it, put on a fairly good display, but there's nothing like seeing, you know, the Queen of the Skies, as it's affectionately known, flying over. And as Grant mentioned, Qantas don't have that many 747s left. So it was really great to see OEH up there. And it was a magnificent display. The roulettes were there and the Air Force always well represented. So, you know, it might be about a motor race, Grant, but I'm glad, like you say, that there's lots of aviation around.
Anyhow, you know, look, talking of Qantas and the 747, something else that's hit Qantas just recently was a bit of a Facebook scam.
Yes, indeed, Grant. And I must say, I saw this shared by a few of my Facebook friends today, and I thought, you know, that just does look a little sus, because the actual scam is promising complimentary first-class lounge invitations, it's saying here. But actually, it doesn't say Qantas. It's got the Qantas logo on it, but it actually says Qantas Airline. And I just thought, you know what, that just looks a little bit of sus. And it took me all of about 15 seconds to work out that it was a scam just by doing a bit of Googling around. And it's a pity that a few more people didn't do that. But I guess that's just what these scam artists were counting on, that most people wouldn't think to check that sort of stuff. So Qantas had to get on its own Facebook page and other social media channels and say, hey, folks, hey, sorry, we're nice people, but, you know, we're not that nice.
Well, there were a couple of other indicators. It wasn't just Qantas Airline. Today, we at Qantas Australia, that's incorrect. And a number of other typos throughout the thing made it kind of obvious that this wasn't really written by one of Qantas's PR people. They at least don't say winners will be inboxed on March 17th, 2015. Hey!
Yeah, that's more the sort of, you know, hip and happening language that, say, Virgin would use, I suppose, but certainly not, you know, the prim and proper Qantas.
Well, definitely not, and I think even Virgin would probably go inboxed. Oh, dear.
Yes, anyway. Well, sorry to get your hopes up, folks. You'll just have to, you know, rack up your Qantas frequent flyer points in the same way that all the rest of us do. You know, I actually rack mine up by putting lots of things on my credit card and paying it off really quickly.
Yeah, I just do mine the old-fashioned way by, you know, flying. Yeah. Because, hey, I'm just out to fly. That's all I want.
You don't even fly Qantas, Grant. You know it. You fly Virgin all the time. I know you. McCarran.
I fly Qantas if the offers are there. But, yeah, generally we do try and fly Virgin. I know. I'm bad. Mm. But sorry to all our friends in Qantas, Jetstar, Tiger, you know.
Et cetera, et cetera. I'll tell you what, one airline I'd like to fly, Grant, would be the Royal Australian Air Force. I shouldn't call them an airline, should I, Grant? But I tell you what, I'd love to get up in one of the C-17s. And, you know, after a hectic couple of weeks of showing off down here, here in Melbourne at the Avalon Air Show, they've been pressed very quickly back into service, this time for something far more serious, and that's to start an air bridge to Vanuatu, which was fairly flattened this week by Tropical Cyclone Pam.
Tropical Cyclone Pam hit Vanuatu square on, pretty much flattened the whole of Port Vila, the capital. And as a result, Australia and New Zealand have been sending aircraft over with assistance on board. Australia has sent a couple of C-17A Globemaster aircraft, the big haulers. We've sent them over with humanitarian supplies from water purification through to nappies, to everything you could need in a place which has been pretty much all but wiped out, and also some aid teams and things like that. And even a C-130J has gone over with a relief team on board.
And also, Grant, the one that I found really interesting was that the Air Force sent across an Orion, an AP-3C, to take some imagery for reconnaissance purposes. So I thought that was really interesting. And there was already one of our Orions in the sort of in the local region over there in the Solomon Islands. So it's a big effort there by the Air Force. And as always, swinging into action very, very quickly for this sort of humanitarian work. They're very, very good at it. And in fact, I must say, Grant, so are the Kiwis.
Yep, both of the Pacific nations have been diving in to help. And you've also seen Air Vanuatu restart its flights as of Monday. They had moved their aircraft off to Sydney and Noumea prior to the arrival of the cyclone, and now that the dust has settled, they're going to start flying back in and out, so that'll probably be bringing much needed assistance as well.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. You know, Grant, this has been a very, very difficult report to really record this week here in the studio. Do you want to know why?
Oh, go on. I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Because my lovely wife has been in here and she's cleaned up the whole studio and I can't find anything.
Oh, no. Oh, the humanity.
No, I almost couldn't even find the microphone.
Oh, well, I mean, your studio is kind of small. I mean, it's admittedly a little bit bigger than Rob's clown car, but I mean, you know, it's not that far for things to go disappearing, is it?
Well, to be fair, Grant, anything's bigger than Rob's clown car.
Well,
I heard your comments last week, Rob Mark.
Yeah, Rob, if you want to see something fun, try and see Steve get into my RX-7.
Still haven't attempted that one.
Yeah, I know. I'll go get the shoehorn.
We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks. You know, Tropical Cyclone Pam, my mother's name's Pam. That's a worry.
Given the destruction done in Vanuatu, I think I'd better be a bit more respectful to your mother.
Me too. Love you, Mum.
Yeah, on you, Mrs. V.
All right, thanks, guys. Did you catch that? Hanging under a hot air balloon without a basket? Is that something that you would ever even contemplate?
On a chairlift chair? What are you, crazy?
Oh, no.
Please.
I don't think I would be interested in that at all. Not at all.
Yeah, I have a hard time on roller coasters.
Yeah. I also am not very, very... it's not a pretty sight with me on a coaster.
Uh-huh.
This Facebook scam, though, boy, that's kind of a scary thing. I don't know if there have been other examples of that in sort of the aviation world, but with social media and the way things travel so fast, you know, around the globe, someone who's got some, you know, bad intent could really disrupt an airline's brand or, you know, the passengers, the customers in some way or another pretty easily. That's kind of a scary thing.
Yeah, but why are these people such bad spellers and so poor with grammar?
I'm just glad they are, because that's usually the tip-off. Well, we get, you know, you all listening probably don't realize this, but in the website at airplanegeeks.com, under the post, of course, there's an opportunity for people to comment. And the number of spam comments that we get, and which never get published because we have a filter for that, are just phenomenal. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of them each week, all kinds of just ridiculous things. And bad spelling is the one common theme across almost all of them. That's the tip off.
Yeah, but if you're a bad speller and you don't know any better, you know, then you got a problem.
Yes.
That's it. You're going in the spam bucket.
That's right. Along with the rest of the bad spellers.
Yeah. Pay attention in school.
Yes.
All right. We have a listener recording. This is from Joel. He sent us a report that you'll find very interesting. You need to sort of cozy up to your speaker or your earbuds, however you're listening to this, and listen to him tell about parabolic flight.
Let me introduce myself. My name is Joel. I am a mechanical engineering teacher at a high school across the pond, as you say. I am also a private pilot. Over here, we say a Sunday pilot. I became pilot because one night, I had a dream. Like most of us, I believed I could fly. 2 hours a week on my schedule, I teach some rudiments of aeronautics to my high school students. We have such programs in France. They learn basics in aerodynamics, aviation terms, navigation, meteorology, and history. Once a year, students can take the commands of a SEP for 1 hour, and it's free, provided that they pass their aviation initiation exam. Last year, with two of my students, we were fortunate enough to fly on board the A300 Fox Bravo Uniform Alpha Delta. What is special with this plane? Not only was it the Airbus No. 3, built in 1979, but it never had any regular passengers. It was used for flight tests and certifications, and then became a flying lab aimed at recreating weightlessness during its parabolic trajectories. About 50 scientists, astronauts, engineers, and technicians were aboard with us. Our school was chosen because we had a project to undertake under zero-gravity environments. Every year, three high schools are selected to deal with their experiments under such conditions. Our goal was to study the behavior of a humanoid robot called Neo during weightlessness phases. At the beginning, we wanted to have it work and see how disoriented it would be. Its reactions would have been interesting to observe, given it has multiple sensors, gyroscopic and inertial devices. Unfortunately, we could not let it walk in the cabin due to very strong precaution rules. Eventually, we decided to tie it up on a special seat and monitor its energy consumption, while its arm would raise a charge. Another experiment would be to get it standing up while its foot was attached to the seat. It had been a long road to achieve this amazing and incredible day. We had to meet several times with the Nova Space team, the company that owns the plane, and we had to fill in many forms. One of the most fascinating meetings we had that Monday afternoon was the pre-flight conference. It was hot in Bordeaux, and nap time is usually a period when my attention is at a very low level, but this time my eyes were wide open, and my ears as well. A bunch of geeks, including French astronaut Jean-François Clairvoyant from CNES, the French NASA, the captain, the current physicist, the team manager, they all presented their contributions. It was fabulous. We wanted nothing better than to take off at once. And we eventually found out how to use this tiny bottle as a substitute for the sealed-off toilets. Apparently nothing was planned for women, for they have no prostate. 12 teams were to fly, and all presented their experiences. So did my pupils. Soon to be the next French astronaut, Thomas Pesquet presented his training for ESA. At first, one place was available on board for my students. 10 of them were involved in the project. It was part of their baccalaureate. Given the student chosen had to be over 18, only 4 could attend. It turned out that 2 of them were highly motivated. They both had succeeded in their aviation initiation exam the year before. They flipped the coin, and I decided to comfort the loser, telling him that sometimes pharmacology labs would hire some guinea pig to test new suppositories in space. I was just kidding. Luckily, one extra position opened up, and the two guys could fly as a birthday present for one of them. I know what you're guessing. How about the teacher? Since I had my medical certificate, I was ready to board. And it happened that a lab had to test, human perception of sounds while blinded under absence of gravity. The aeronaut is safe, except if you see pictures of me harnessed with a huge headset and an even larger vision mask. Here we go. The DD was there. The day before, they had launched the new EFAN, an Airbus electric plane, from the airport. We were so busy, we could not see it. Anyway, we were airborne. When the sign turned off, one could hear 50 bell clicks at a time before everyone rushed to his work zone. My students awoke now and started to torture the poor beast. During 3 hours, from FL-200 to FL-270, we encountered 31 parabolas. Each one would give us 22 seconds of weightlessness. I'm fond of this word. My persecutors released me for the last 3 parabolas, and I could take advantage of a free flight zone. I have to mention that a parabola is about 1 minute time. During the first 20 seconds, you double your weight, as for the 20 last ones. Trying to fly in is not that easy. Flooring is risky. Some pictures could prove it. But that was magic, my friends. You feel free. There is no word to describe such a feeling. It was like in my dream. You know what, guys? Now, type it in, hey ho, I am sure I can fly.
Wow. You know, I would never hang myself underneath a hot air balloon in a little seat like that, but to go on one of these parabolic flights and experience weightlessness, I think that would be a real interesting experience. I could really go for that.
And that's because you're safe inside this metal tube the entire time. Sure, you might bounce off the ceiling or the walls or the floor a few times, but yeah, you're protected.
Yeah, you feel a sense of security, even though it may not be rational, but yeah, that's true. But I want to thank Joel for sending that in. Boy, the guy's got a sense of humor, too. I think there's a few moments there that are pretty entertaining. But what a great teacher to be able to facilitate students experiencing this kind of a thing and all the learning that goes along with it. Just that's fantastic.
Absolutely. Binet, have you ever been on one of those flights?
No.
Would you?
No.
No?
Huh. Well, if someone offers you a ticket, let me know. I'll go in your place.
Oh, if somebody's going to offer me a ticket, then yes, I will.
Okay.
I'm not just going to wake up one morning and say, hey, I want to do a parabolic flight. No, no, no.
No vomit comment for you, huh?
No.
All right. Well, let's move on to some listener mail. You know, we were talking earlier about accuracy and things like that. And, well, I got called to task. We had a couple of emails and a comment on the website. I think it was the last episode when I mentioned visiting a Nike missile site outside of Tucson, near Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. Well, I guess it wasn't a Nike missile site. It might have been a Titan missile site. Because, like I said, we heard from several, including Stephen, who sent along some great links, including to the Titan Missile Museum, TitanMissileMuseum.org, and some others. We'll put those in the show notes. But there's a photo in there on that Titan missile site of the, I don't remember what they call it, the control room, you know, where the big red button is that the two guys sit down and that's how you launch the, the missile. And that looks exactly like what I remember. So I think those guys are right. I think my memory failed me. It wasn't a Nike missile site, that it was a Titan missile site. So thanks for the corrections, guys. We can always count on our listeners to tell us when we're drifting from the truth or accuracy.
Oh, come on. Someone presses a red button, a rocket goes up, and at the other end, it's a big kaboom.
Yeah, either way.
Yeah, it's not good at the other end.
Yeah, yeah. One of these links is to missile sites, around that area. And it is pretty interesting stuff. Daniel talked about airlines, defunct airlines or airlines from the past and sort of the nostalgia and the interest in those. This is kind of a similar sort of a thing. I mean, it was an era that we don't, as far as we know, really experience these days. But when you look at the Cold War history and get a chance to go to some of these places where, quite literally the world could have ended, it's pretty powerful. David Robinson sent us an email. This was very interesting. There's a podcast. It's called the Generation Y Podcast. And he was a guest on a recent episode, actually episode 111. And this is about D.B. Cooper, subtitle, Skydiver's Analysis. Now, you guys remember D.B. Cooper, right? We're all old enough to remember D.B. Cooper, aren't we?
Oh, yes, I remember D.B. Cooper.
Right.
Yep.
This is the guy that parachuted out, jumped out of the back of the 727 in the northwest of the United States after collecting a sort of a ransom. Never to be heard from again. And there's all kinds of conspiracy theories about that and so forth. Well, David Robinson is a skydiver. He's got a lot of experience with this, and he came on the show on the Generation Y podcast to talk about it kind of from a technical standpoint, you know, what some of the issues might have been and so forth, and very interesting. So a link to that episode of the Generation Y podcast you'll find in the show notes. As always, the show notes for all of our episodes are airplanegeeks.com/ and the episode number. So in this case, airplanegeeks.com/341.
And Max, that was November 24th, 1971.
Ah, 71.
Yeah, Northwest Orient flight number 305.
I was still in high school.
Oh. Yeah, this is definitely the trip down memory lane show, isn't it?
It is. Speaking of memory, Mark Newton sent us an email. He mentions the Historical Aircraft Restoration Society, HARS, that they own a Lockheed Super Constellation, which they had recovered from the same Davis-Monthan Air Base, Air Force Base that we've been talking about, and restored it to airworthy status. He says that it does fly. It cost them a lot to fly it, as you know, you could imagine, so it doesn't fly very often. And so we have a link to that that we'll put in the show notes. That's pretty spectacular. They've also just recently taken delivery. This is the HARS Museum in Australia, taken delivery of the Boeing 747-400 that was donated by Qantas. So you can look for that information in the show notes. And then Patrick Wiggins sent us an email. He says, mentioning the boneyards in the desert, it said, it reminds me of a different boneyard of sorts located in Washington, D.C. Now I'm thinking, a boneyard?
Yes.
Located in Washington, D.C.?
Congress?
I miss the No, he says, namely the Air and Space Museum, which I guess in some ways that's kind of true, because there are a lot of aircraft in their possession besides what you see at the museum. I mean, that was the whole motivation. Well, I think that was a major motivation for building the Udvar-Hazy Center next to Dulles Airport, is all the aircraft that they had and no place to show them. But Patrick mentioned something kind of interesting, and he says that at one point they had an unused satellite, and we talk about resurrecting aircraft from the desert, from the boneyard. Well, it was there for several years, he says, but they eventually retrieved the satellite. This is a Transit O satellite. They retrieved it, they refitted it, and they actually launched it into space. So there's a satellite up there that was, you know, kind of came from the National Air and Space Museum. I've got a link to the article about that, or some information about that Transit O satellite that we'll put
pretty
in the
show. Pretty cool recycling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, satellites don't come cheap. I mean,
yeah.
And so, yeah, what a great use. All right. I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. As I mentioned, this is episode 341. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher.com, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for Airplane Geeks. If you'd like to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We want to thank our guest, D. Daniel Morley. That's Morley. Find him at airlinegeeks.com. His Twitter handle is Morley the Pilot, Morley the Pilot. And his Facebook page is Daniel Morley. Benet Wilson, we want to thank you so much for joining us as co-host. I want to wish you great success with your new endeavor. Tell folks again where they can find more Benet.
Thank you so much, Max. I'm at aviationqueen.com, @QueenBenet on Twitter. I'm on Google Plus and Facebook. I actually have an Aviation Queen Facebook page. So there you go.
Fantastic. And Brian Coleman, tell folks where they can reach you if they want to get in touch.
Oh, the best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And if anyone is interested in the archive of back issues of Airplane Geeks, they can contact you for more information about that.
Absolutely.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Goodbye, everyone.
Daniel,
No, Max, I was just going to say, it's over here, it's something for the outtakes. Are you playing with your cord? The microphone cord? Yeah.
I have.
It's just bouncing around a lot. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I told you to swallow it. Yeah. No one listened to me. No one listened.
Well, if you don't mind 1 second, it actually appears that my power cord is caught in my headphones, and that's probably what you hear bouncing around.
Okay, yeah, go ahead and fix that.
Sorry, Max, that was just driving me crazy.
Yeah, sorry about that. I just noticed that, and I don't know how, that's like, it was wrapped around my ear, and I didn't notice that.
Yeah,
wow.
It doesn't take much to...
I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
Okay, where were we?
Take a glass of water so it'll stay in your throat.
And interestingly, Grant, they've also sent an AP-3C Orion to go over there and do some imagery. Interestingly also, Grant, there was already one P-3 Orion on the ground there, one of ours in the Solomon. Oh, sorry, that's the Solomon Islands. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say it was actually in the Solomons, yeah.
I'll start that again. And also, Grant, something I found interesting here is that the Air Force also dispatched an AP-3C Orion to go over and take some images there to study, you know, doing reconnaissance flights. And that sounds terrible. I'm going to do that again. And also, Grant, the one that I found really interesting was that the Air Force sent across an Orion. An AP-
Max, and Max, you forgot to ask Benet about the phone number.
But we don't do it every time. You know, nobody ever calls.
No one calls us?
No.
We do it every time.
We haven't.
I'm gonna call.
Okay. And if you do call Benet, what's the number that you would dial?
I would dial 361 Geeks 01.